how real world assets fit into DeFi and why DeFi need real world assets as well, especially during a bull market.
One of the things that people often say about gold, you know, it doesn't give a yield. So US Treasuries, you can take the 10-year, you're yielding 4.16% today. Gold yields nothing if you own it. So if you can turn around and say, well, actually mine finance, I'll tell you what, I'm putting a yield of 10 or 15% on the gold, and you're going to lock it up for 3 years and you're going to get this 15% coupon per annum, that's the structured finance you'll do.
If we tokenize gold bars, then the way that we would approach that is basically by probably using individual NFTs representing individual gold bars, because then you know that this NFT has a unique characteristic in that it's mapped directly to one single gold bar that's sitting somewhere.
Tokenized assets has been a growing segment of DeFi, with RWA total value locked sitting at $5 billion in December 2023, according to DeFi Llama. Now, why real-world asset tokenization matter to DeFi? We are going to find out more in this interview with Timo Less and Mark Chai. So what are the benefits of real-world asset tokenization? Greater liquidity, transparency to promote investor trust and confidence, efficiency, low cost, accessibility, more inclusive investing option, trading 24/7, and many, many more benefits. But there are also drawbacks, and the regulatory and legal not so clear framework is one of the main one. And then obviously you have got security and custody. Before we get into the show, super important disclaimer. We don't offer any financial or investing advice on the Financial Fox. The content is only for informational purposes. And remember that any decision that you make regarding your money is always down to you. So you need to be informed, you need to make research, and you need to get educated. Like everything you do in your life, you need to know what you're doing. And remember, financial markets, especially crypto markets, are very volatile. There is a lot of risk. So make sure that you do your own research and you learn, you speed up, you skill up with all this innovation that is happening in finance, but also and mainly in the technology space. Finally, I'm gonna ask you something that is very important for me and for all the team at the Financial Fox. If you are watching our content and you haven't yet subscribed to our channel or join our community, please take a moment to do it. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, join our social media, not only to stay up to date with our news interviews, but also to support us, be part of our community, ever say, send us comment on our videos on YouTube. And we are on Twitter, we are on Discord, we are on LinkedIn. We will be more than happy than hear the feedback that you have. I'm trying to bring the most interesting guest on the channel to discuss the most interesting topic that I feel are changing the world of finance, they are changing our economy and our society. So take a moment to join our community and please send us feedback. Finally, I'm just gonna mention that briefly. We have already sent out an announcement. We are launching the Financial Fox Club, and we have a Financial Fox Ordinal NFT drop coming up. So if you're interested, go on our channel and you are going to find all the information about the project that we are launching. It's a way to engage more with our community. There is a strong focus on education and female empowerment as well. And I'm a big advocate of having more female founders in the space. So I think it's very important that I communicate this message, and if you feel the same, get in touch with us and join our community. Hi Mark, hi Timo, how are you?
Yeah, very good, thanks. Good to meet you.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm quite excited about this discussion that we are going to have about real world assets. So before we get started, let's start with the usual round of introduction. So, people listening know who you are and where you come from.
Yeah, so Timo Less, I'm a co-founder of Swarm. So I have a background in basically tech entrepreneurship and tech investing predominantly, and then also actually in TradFi for a few years as and as an M&A advisor, so I did a bunch of transactions to buy and sell technology companies. So that's kind of what I did before I started Swarm together with Philip. And well, I suppose since 14 was the first time I got in contact with blockchain companies. And then in 2017, I got involved with Swarm in its first incarnation. And then Philip and I have since then, we've moved everything from Silicon Valley to Europe because we saw that there was a regulatory environment in Europe that was more beneficial for what we were building. And so since 2019, we've been set up in Germany as a base and been building Swarm ever since. And we're basically an RWA issuance and redemption company, and we also provide liquidity platforms for secondary liquidity for RWAs.
Super. I remember talking to you, Timo and Philip, back before COVID. So, yeah, I know you have been around for a long time. Mark, do you want just quickly introduce yourself, even though you have been on the show quite a few times now?
Yes. yes, thank you. Yes, I'm Mark Child. I've got a background for 15, 20 years in finance, both across the stockbroking, the venture capital and private equity corporate finance side, in early stage technologies, quite a lot of that, and some frontier markets. The last 12 years, I have been involved with Condor Gold, which I've really created from the first drill hole to about 100,000 meters of drilling. And we drilled up to the point where we have 2.5 million ounces of gold in the ground. So that's about $5 billion worth of gold. We've then bought all the land, about 1,000 hectares, the surface rights. We bought a mill. We've got all the permits to construct and operate it. So it's now construction ready or shovel ready in our business. And we're now in the process of selling the asset, which is quite often the case in the exploration sector, where the junior takes the risk, 1 in 100, finds something really interesting, and then you put it up for sale. Like the big guys, you've got the balance sheets and gold mines to actually go and build this. So that's my background, and we're in an advanced stage of a sale process at the moment.
Fantastic. I'm really glad that, you know, here on the panel, we have somebody more kind of degen in the tokenization digital asset space and somebody else that actually see the opportunity, but it comes more from a TradFi background, building a company that has got real world assets. So I think that's kind of like very good mix. And usually this kind of like discussion about RWA is mainly from people, more in the digital asset space. So let's start maybe with one of like basic question. What is a real world assets tokenization? And maybe Timo, you want to answer this question.
Yeah, so I think the way that we define it is basically anything that's not like a native digital instrument. So if you think about all crypto, they're essentially bearer instruments for carrying their own value. If they are coins or utility tokens or payment tokens or whatever they are, stable coins, whatever they are, they all carry their own value within the digital framework. Real world assets, there's basically a linkage between the digital world and the real world. So which means that you have a digital representation of a real world asset, an underlying asset, and that could be, you know, commodities, it could be securities, it could be a real estate, it could be any kind of underlying value or intellectual property. And so we started looking at which categories that would be the most suitable to tokenize and you know, what you could actually do with them once you have tokenized them and brought them onto the blockchain. So, starting with things like very well-known financial instruments such as Tesla stocks, Apple stocks, and, you know, like the big names that people are very familiar with, we thought was a good place to start for a couple of different reasons. Number one, when you're doing something novel, you don't want to do it with something novel underlying in this case, because then we would both have to explain what the digitization process looks like in the first place, but then we would also have to describe the underlying assets. And that becomes very complicated for people to kind of get a grasp on and build confidence in. So that's why we took something that everybody knows what it is, let's call it an Apple stock, and then we bring that onto the blockchain. And then the question is like, okay, so now what can I do with it now? And that's kind of the next step of this process, right? But the key thing is to be able to transparently demonstrate how the digital depository receipt is actually what the legal claim is, or what that represents from a legal point of view towards the underlying asset. So we spent a lot of time and effort on making that as transparent and as clear as possible so that people can find confidence in that if I hold this digital asset, then it actually means that I own something of an underlying asset as well, i.e. the real world assets. In our case, we make that linkage between a tokenized Apple stock and the underlying stock itself that's sitting in a institutional custody account, and it's held by, you know, a legal construct that people can basically go to and say, hey, I have this token, I'm the owner of one of the underlying Apple stocks in your brokerage account. And then, so that whole connection, I think, is really important, because otherwise you're holding this token, but you don't really know what the asset is that backs it, unless it's like super clear that it's a one-to-one backing to a real-world underlying asset. People have come up with other constructs that, you know, are synthetic and have other kind of value, you know, tracking instruments and things like that, but it's not the same thing.
So interesting. So Mark, if you think about tokenizing the gold that you have in Condor Gold Mine in Nicaragua, what would you say are the challenges? You know, think about that you maybe decide to tokenize it. What do you see being the challenge? And maybe let's put them to Timo and see how he would reply. Because you said, you know, Apple stock, but what is a much better example that actually something that you can see shiny, so like gold?
Yeah, I think there's two ways to answer your question. One, I think, is actually gold itself and tokenizing that. And there are several people who've done and doing that, and there'll be other people who join that market. So one of the problems with gold, and if you have a gold bar, it's difficult to spend, it's difficult to store, it's difficult to redeem, it's kind of old-fashioned. It's not, the market needs, in my view, the gold market for retail and wholesale needs a massive transformation, so it can be used as a digital back currency around the world, a tokenized currency, similar to Bitcoin, but it's actually going to be gold, which is today $13 trillion. And there are a number of people kind of working on that, including the World Gold Council, which is the trade body for the top 30 odd gold producers in the world, who've got $100 million budget to try and get people to buy more gold effectively, and this would be one of the ways. So there's a tokenization of gold on a much bigger scale. And as you know, Stephanie, I think Tether Gold are the biggest people at the moment, with about $500 million worth of gold. And if you go to the Tether Gold website, you can see that's fully redeemable in Switzerland, where I am at the moment. The mine finance, I think this is going to be a massive transformation over the next 10 years, not just for gold, but for copper and precious and base metals. So if you've got 2.5 million ounces of gold, that sounds an awful lot, $5 billion. You're not going to be able to tokenize all of that. So you're going to have to look to the mine plans. You'll have to get them signed off to about what we call a bankable feasibility study. And maybe half of it goes into a bankable feasibility study. And then it might take 10 years to get it out. And so there'll be a percentage of that which can be lent. And I think the future of mine finance, one of the futures, is going to be the way that funds raise assets via a tokenized gold and from anywhere in the world, and against a particular asset where you get repaid back into the physical asset with a percentage. So if I put that in another way, the old-fashioned gold loans, which the British used to lend to South Africa 300 years ago, that's how gold mines got financed all over Africa, in difficult parts of the world, with difficult regimes. They'd lend against the asset, whatever, £50 million, and they got repaid that in physical gold with a big coupon and return. And that's the classic gold loan, simplistically put. Take that into the digital world, that's not happened yet, but that's exactly the way I see it happening. I see fund managers from even some of the bigger names having fund structures to finance mines around the world, and it could be uranium, it could be lithium for the electric car industry, it could be gold, copper, using a digital form of finance with the repayment with the physical part. So that's how I see the future going.
I've got a question, because, you know, when you are doing, obviously you have got to deal with gold, for example, lithium or any natural resources, there is an element of risk that you never know, you know, how much you get out, how much it's going to cost, all these kind of variables that add layer of volatility to the tokenization. So my question is, how do you include that when you are issuing a token? How that works?
I think that is part of the difficulty. And I would actually go lean on part of Timur's answer when he said, well, we're tokenizing the known names, so the Apples of this world, the Microsoft, the Nvidia. And I think that for it to start off in mine finance, say gold mines, what will probably happen is it'll start with some of, and it needs the CEOs to be creative and open-minded, of the big, if you took the top 10 gold producers in the West, in Canada, Australia, and the USA, that their source of financing is obviously equity and debt at the moment, and the debt's from the banks or the royalty companies or the private equity companies. And I see them leading the way for people to get comfortable, so that if you say, have you heard of Newmont or Barrick? Well, those are the top two gold producers in North America. So, and therefore you've got a big form of collateral. I think the juniors like Condor Gold, and I don't like to say this, but we're going to be much more risky than someone who's actually producing and who's a big listed company anyway. So I think it becomes a finance mix for the existing gold, top 10 gold producers to begin with. And then it'll trickle down to the more risky, dare I say, junior gold producers. Probably the similar to you, Timo, is you'll find that you start with the Apples and the Microsofts, but eventually you'll move down the market cap chain.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are many layers of like tokenizing gold. It's actually a really good use case because it's, like you said, Mark, it's a very cumbersome asset to hold. Right, it's like it's heavy. It's somebody might want to steal it. You know, it's just there's a number of things that are quite impractical around holding gold as such, and so it kind of lends itself really well for tokenization. And of course, you know, the key thing is always like, you know, if we tokenize gold bars, then the way that we would approach that is basically by probably using individual NFTs representing individual gold bars, because then you know that this NFT has a unique characteristic in that it maps directly to one single gold bar that's sitting somewhere. So that's like the one-to-one mapping layer of this. But then, of course, you also need to have the commoditized version, which is then, you know, a bundle of NFTs that get put together, which basically becomes like a gold asset. And then you can issue a, you know, ubiquitous gold token against that underlying asset. So I think that's on actually holding the gold at itself in a digital form. That's kind of what is needed. And that's something that we've built already. So I think it's like, I think the technology is there. It's more about like the legal structure. Who are the participants? How do we trust them? How do we make sure everything is there? Like all of those things, like the auditability of the underlying asset and those aspects. I think that's like actually still to be solved, I think, for most tokenized gold out there. And that's even a completely different asset to what you're describing, which is the exploration financing, which is a different process, which is really more about like who is willing to risk that, you know, to finance that particular activity in order to get a certain type of return on the other side of it. And that's, I think that's more like a, you know, it's, I'm sure there's very structured ways to do that within the gold industry, but it is a distinctly different thing from just like tokenizing gold itself.
No, it is. And one of the things that people often say about gold, you know, it doesn't give a yield. So US Treasuries, you can take the 10-year, you're yielding 4.16% today. Gold yields nothing if you own it. So if you can turn around and say, well, actually mine finance, I'll tell you what, I'm going to put a yield of 10 or 15% on the gold, and you're going to lock it up for 3 years and you're going to get this 15% coupon per annum, that's the structured finance you'll do. So not only have you got gold, you've got gold with a coupon of 10 or 15% to reflect the risk that you're taking. And then if you're borrowing 100 million, in our case, it would be fully collateralized over $5 billion worth of gold in the ground. So yeah, your risks are pretty small. Yes, you've got execution risk and your frontier market risk and politics. And yeah, but that's hopefully gets reflected in whatever terms and rate of return you're going to have on the investment.
Yeah.
And I think on that point, Timo, it would be great if you can kind of unpack how real world assets fit into DeFi and why DeFi need a real world assets as well, especially during a bull market.
Yeah, well, first in general, just to expand the ecosystem, I think since we saw the emergence of Tether as a stablecoin, you know, it solved a very specific problem on the exchanges. Like, how do I step out of the market without stepping off chain necessarily, or without actually leaving crypto? Because that was impractical, because then you would have to do a wire transfer every time. So stablecoins became like a very clear kind of, you know, it's, if you think about stablecoins, it is effectively tokenized cash. So it's the first kind of real world asset that took a kind of a firm position within the crypto ecosystem. And now, of course, you know, Tether is extremely profitable. Circle is extremely profitable. So now people are starting to look at like, okay, so what do they actually do, you know, with the money that, you know, when they tokenize cash, what happens? And then, of course, underlying that is a mix of, you know, money market funds and treasury bonds and other commercial paper and other things that, you know, act as collateral towards the stablecoin issuance. And then so you can basically say that, okay, if that's the case for stablecoins, then why don't we do that for a bunch of other things as well? Because even if stablecoins solve one particular aspect of the DeFi or crypto ecosystem, then there are also, there's value of bringing other assets on chain as well. So of course, you know, to have assets on chain that are somewhat less correlated or completely uncorrelated to what's going on in crypto has value, because that provides, you know, just a counterweight in terms of the types of strategies that you can build and also kind of how you want to position yourself in the market. So if you step out of the crypto market, you might not want to go to a zero yielding environment just because you don't want to be in the crypto market. You actually, you know, probably might want to go to a tokenized treasury bond ETF, which then, like you said, Mark, will yield, a 10-year would yield 4% something, right? And that then becomes basically like a treasury product in some ways, in the sense that any project or anyone that's holding a bunch of US dollars on chain, they can put that into a bond or a bond ETF, and then that becomes a yielding asset. So there's a very clear kind of use case for that, just like not having dormant assets sitting around. And then the other thing is, like, once you start looking at, like, okay, so if we now have an integration of TradFi people with DeFi, then what does that mean? Well, then it means that people that have significant equity holdings outside of crypto are now entering crypto. And I think this year we'll see even more of that, simply because the ETFs in the US becomes like not only a validation point, but also somewhat of a gateway drug to get into the crypto market. So we have a lot of people that have a bunch of equities and equity portfolios that are now looking at, like, okay, so what should be my exposure into the crypto market? So now all of a sudden we're seeing that you can use tokenized Apple, Tesla, MicroStrategy, Microsoft, what have you, as a digitized asset in the DeFi ecosystem to say, if I have 100 Apple shares, I might want to allocate, basically use that as collateral to borrow stablecoins against that asset and then go and invest in crypto with that. So now I'm not obviously selling my equity portfolio, but I'm leveraging it for something that I couldn't do on a traditional margin lending account on a brokerage, but, you know, because I can't really buy crypto there. And then so I can do that on chain instead. So I use my stock portfolio as a collateral to buy any kind of crypto asset that I'm interested in investing in. And I think so that's, you know, the only thing you can do today on a brokerage account is basically you can use your Apple stocks to buy some ETF, i.e. basically a Bitcoin ETF, or outside of the US, you can buy, obviously, there's a bunch of other ETFs for ETH and Solana and other assets as well. However, that's still kind of confined within the TradFi market, trading hours and settlement cycles and all the rest of it. And then there's, you know, obviously overlaid with a bunch of fees that you don't have in native crypto. So I think looking at how to integrate stocks into the DeFi ecosystem, it's an like the first use case is just like, well, just borrow against that asset, because it's a dormant, if you bring it on chain and it just sits there, it becomes a dormant asset. You can use it as its excellent collateral. It's somewhat less correlated to crypto than crypto itself, obviously. Even the tech stocks are, you know, not, I mean, yes, there's some correlation on a kind of a macro level when we go through like risk on risk off cycles, but at the same time, they're not the same assets by any mean, really. And therefore, you know, they are uncorrelated. And so you can basically use them as such when you invest in other things that you might find interesting on the crypto side.
Timo, I've got a little question, because I was reviewing your website earlier, and it's fascinating what you're doing. You're very much a first mover in the space. When you talk about, just look at my notes here, when you talk about there's $11 million locked up in the Swarm protocol, could you explain that to me? What do you mean by that?
It's basically all the assets that are somewhat like managed by Swarm. So okay, that's across various things. It's liquidity pools, it's outright custody, it's whatever is sitting on our OTC contracts. So anything that is linked to our infrastructure for digital assets, so we're adding up all those numbers. So it's a combination of, well, I would say actually it's more crypto values today than real world asset values. If you take like the total number, but then the real world asset side gradually is growing faster, so that we see that with, especially with the lending use case, because we haven't announced the a lending partner yet. So okay, that's something that's coming quite soon. And so I think with the lending use case, it just becomes very clear, you know, what the value is of having tokenized stocks on chain. Because initially it was just like, why would I buy Apple on chain when I can buy it in my brokerage account? And that's kind of a very obvious question, right? And I think
it's probably your number one question that you get.
Yeah, so it's one of those things where you can argue that, well, you know, 24/7 trading and instant settlement is worth something, and you know, and it is to some people, but also maybe it's not enough of a value today yet. So you need to kind of add something that is really like a, oh, this I could never do in TradFi, but I can only do it in crypto. And there we see that, you know, using stocks as collateral for kind of ubiquitous borrowing against it, that doesn't exist in TradFi unless you're obviously on institutional level or family office. So I think that's where people will see like, oh, this is super useful, and then I can borrow against it. And then so gradually that moves more and more TradFi assets on chain, and then that's going to grow the TVL. So that I think that the real world asset side will supersede the native crypto assets eventually. It's just that it takes a lot of time. I mean, as you know, tokenizing gold or tokenizing real estate or tokenizing even, you know, public securities, There's so much volume there. It takes time to kind of move that on chain because we're still working with MetaMask and other things that are way too complicated for non-crypto natives to deal with.
I have got a question. When you have to choose a blockchain to tokenize assets, most the industry seems then leaning towards Ethereum. Can you maybe share some insights on why that, and if there are any other layer ones that are making some interesting moves with the tokenization?
Yeah, I think actually it's very multifaceted. So on the kind of very heavy TradFi institutional side, you have things like JP Morgan Onyx. So they have built their own blockchain. And then you have like basically like private networks that people are using for tokenizing assets. So we know that that's been in existence for quite a while, actually. And then of course, you know, you can argue that, well, they are basically tokenizing real world assets, but like for whom and like for what are the use cases and what's the accessibility of that? So that exists, but it's basically private chain implementation, right? So that's like one category. And then you have like completely permissioned, like Ethereum, like you mentioned. Well, okay, so that's like a go-to layer one. Of course, transaction costs are reasonably high comparatively, and also, but I think the trust is there. So I think we've seen that with regulators, they are now okay with, as long as you can kind of fulfill all the other requirements that a regulator would have, i.e. are you able to basically do your AML checks for every transaction that's happening, and do you know who the counterparties are for the situations where you need to know who the counterparties are involved, that are involved in a transaction. So as long as you can fulfill those requirements from a regulator point of view, you can use permissionless networks. That's our experience anyway. So it's possible to kind of use completely decentralized infrastructure and still be compliant from a regulatory point of view. So that's a really good thing. But then specifically with Ethereum, you know, it's not so slow anymore. I mean, sometimes there's congestion, whatever, but like it's actually the transaction cost is really prohibitive for certain use cases. So therefore we've been tokenizing both on real world assets, both on Ethereum as well as on Polygon. But Polygon obviously is a little bit more niche. It's a layer two and it's built, you know, connected with Ethereum as an underlying infrastructure, but it does allow us to have a much lower transaction cost and faster transactions. And then, so we're also seeing other ways to approach the whole compliance problem, for example. One is the way that Avalanche is addressing it, which is by creating these what they call subnets. So they have like specific networks for specific use cases and asset types that basically they compartmentalize their blockchain and say, you can only, you know, participate on this side of the subnet if you have qualified through these and these and these criteria. So that's another way to deal with that situation. And they've built that architecture to make that happen. And then, of course, you know, we launched on Base, which is Coinbase's implementation in DeFi. So we built our decentralized OTC contract on Base because we think that user demographic is quite interesting going forward. So once we have now we've brought real world assets to the Base network, and so basically you can, you know, start buying, you know, stocks and things like that to use in DeFi applications on Base. And so, you know, we kind of think about it more in terms of like, where do we see enough of an ecosystem to create something interesting for the users? So like, okay, so there needs to be a number of things in place in order for that to make sense. And then we saw that Base was the most sensible as a next step for us going from Ethereum and Polygon and onwards. You know, obviously we know the Avalanche guys as well. And it's always a question of like, you know, where's the action and where do we think the action will be specifically around the things that we are building.
Super interesting. I'm familiar with the Avalanche subnet, and I think it was something very innovative they were doing already quite a few years ago, especially for brands and companies. They want to have their own control, but they still want to rely on maybe a layer one. That's the way they can build their own subnet. But talking more about the challenges and the drawbacks of tokenization, we obviously mentioned about regulation, which is an issue, but there are many others like security, like liquidity, like governance as well, linking those data from off-chain to on-chain. So I would like to ask you, both of you, what you see being the biggest challenge to tokenization, and you both come from two different perspectives, so I also appreciate Mark's point of view on that, where Timo, maybe yours is more within the industry. Let's put the regulatory aspect aside. What are the others?
Well, I think it's how do you prove that, when you have this token, that there's actually something backing it? And that evidence is super important. And it started even back with Tether, when, Tether had a lot of criticism for just like, well, how do we know that you have the money that's backed by, like, represented by all the Tether coins out there? And it's like, well, we do. And it's like, well, how do we know? And then, so then they started disclosing, what the actual collateral was. And I think that process is now, when for RWAs, it has to be super transparent. So it basically has to be, you don't want to have to go to an organization to ask like, hey, guys, is this for real? You want to be able to self-verify basically what the underlying assets are and that they're there. So the way that we approached that was basically to say, okay, so each token will have within its NFT itself, if it's representing a unique real-world asset, will have a link on-chain to a data store that basically shows, what that underlying asset is in its unique identity, and it's also whatever representations it has in the real world, so to speak. So you can always go and say, okay, this token represents this, in the case of gold, this exact gold bar, or in the case of a security, it's a particular stock sitting on a particular brokerage account. And you might even have the ability to provide like pass-through visibility into the underlying number of stocks that have been issued a token against, and then you can match up the numbers to make sure, it's all there. So I think that's because the trust thing is like with native crypto, you don't have to know anything else that, like, if I hold a coin, I always know that I have the coin value attributed to it. But with RWAs, you don't. So you have to basically ensure yourself that this coin actually represents the underlying thing. And I think so, and for stable coins, I think that's been a really good proof point for this. And I think that's matured over the years in a really positive direction where, apart from people being, somewhat unhappy with not being able to tap into the yield that Circle and Tether are making their money from.
Money off, exactly.
And which is, by the way, significant amounts, right?
Yeah, $4 billion. Last year for
Tether. Yeah, it's huge, actually. But, even if you accept that and say, well, let's say, that's the cost of solving this particular problem, then I think the confidence has been built around both Tether and Circle in terms of what they represent. And then you have things like Luna that blow up because of whatever reason. So I think but the big difference there is that both Circle and Tether are real world asset backed stable coins. I think that's the good part. So, that's like the generation one, I would say, of RWAs. And now we're building generation two and three of RWAs. And it's all about the transparency and the legal rights towards the collateral and the underlying assets. And also for a lot of buyers of these assets and users, it's also actually about compliance. So for our stocks, for example, we filed retail prospectuses so that we can not only distribute this to institutional buyers, but also distribute to retail, because otherwise it becomes like very limited in terms of the use cases. So it's like ubiquitous asset access is important, so it's not only institutional, and then also, and that is kind of linked to compliance, obviously. But then the most important thing is always like trusting that the underlying asset is actually represented by the token. That's the key thing, I would say.
You've articulated that very well. I think with real world assets, it's going to be, is it really backed with what you'll say it's backed by? And that's going to be the biggest thing that goes through. And for a massive adoption of that, We can put regulation to the side, but unfortunately that's going to be in many cases if we get institutional money or any bank money or the wholesale use of real world assets tokenized is going to be the big boys, and they're going to be regulated one way or the other, whether one likes it or not. So I think it's going to, which is why you have in Europe, thankfully, it's probably why you're there, why you're here, I should say, Timo, is at least you have a regulation act passed here. And so that's going to be the big thing. For bigger assets like gold, what I can tell you is happening there is that there's two sides to this. The World Gold Council, the trade body, has come up with three pillars for tokenization. They'd like to see, I think long term, looking at 10, 20 years, the entire industry tokenized. I can see that sort of happening. So they see a digitalization of gold happening. They've been very quiet on exactly how they see that moving. So what they've done is they said we should have three pillars to this tokenization of a real world asset. And so the World Gold Council has said we want to have a pillar of integrity, accessibility and fungibility. So those are that partly answers your question, Steffi. So if they're thinking like that, you can be sure that other people, whether real world assets, whether it's property or commercial property, or whether it's a base metal or something else, they're going to come up with principles. And so on integrity, what they're saying for gold is that they've partnered with the LBMA, so the London Bullion Market Association, which checks whether the gold is correctly stamped, i.e. where it's coming from. They banned, for example, gold coming in from Russia, I believe. And you've got to bear in mind that 20% of the gold in the world is actually done by artisanal miners. So that's, you know, tracing the sources of it. And is there some dirty money in the background somewhere? You know, cartels in Colombia or whatever. Yes. And so that's why the LBMA has these standards of proof of origin. So the chain and the tokenization can actually clean all that up as well. It's not just the pricing, it's actually the supply chain. And I think that's the beauty of it, a lot of people miss. And then accessibility, they're talking 24/7. So they called this new policy Gold 247 unoriginally. So back to the markets aren't closed, just open. Yeah, breakfast till 9 a.m. to 5 or something. And the third part's going to be the fungibility, i.e. the fragmentation, because the market today is incredibly fragmented with gold all globally, and that's actually preventing it becoming more tradable, ironically. So I think they want an agnostic token that's accepted. So I think they're going to be pushing for something big. It's under wraps at the moment, I suspect, but that's the direction of it. So they've come up with principles. I think other real world assets will do the same.
Well, we are seeing really big moves in the space. So I think, Mark, what you said, that the financial industry is going to be soon completely revolutionized by tokens, I think is really happening right now. Yeah. And let's see where he's going with the bull market underway as well. This conversation has been great. We went on a bit longer than I expected, but thank you so much for coming on and sharing your insight.
No, thanks, Steffi, for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.